Hi, Vanessa here. Are you a counselor, a therapist, or other type of licensed behavioral health clinician? If so, you may be interested in a book I wrote called Burnout, Self-Care for Behavioral Health Clinicians. Check it out at therapistassets.com, also known as VanessaLexShop.com.
This is Unraveled, and I'm your host, Vanessa, and here is the podcast.
My guest today, Tiffany Anton, is a psychotherapist specializing in sex and relationships. Tiffany has been helping individuals and couples experience erotic pleasure for over 18 years. Tiffany graduated with a master's in social work from Loyola University, Chicago. Tiffany has been trained by industry leaders such as Dr. Damina Rinsaw, John Gottman, and Gina Ogden. Tiffany is now an educator in the Gottman 7 Principles for Making Marriage Work program. Tiffany is a regular contributor on Your Tango and We Want More Now. Tiffany's written work has been syndicated by MSNBC, Fox News, and Your Tango. Tiffany works one-on-one with clients, speaks at conferences, and works on her online retail store, Erotic Stitch. Tiffany has a podcast called Tiffany Turned On, where she explores the desires and questions hidden deep in the hearts of pleasure seekers. Tiffany is a mother, a horse lover, and a community activist. Thank you for being here with us today, Tiffany. I greatly appreciate your time and your expertise.
Oh, I'm happy to be here with you, Vanessa.
Can you walk us through your journey in the behavioral healthcare field and how it all began and what led you to where you're at right now?
I graduated from Ball State University, which is only popular because of David Letterman. And that was in 95 with a bachelor's degree in social work. At that time, I worked with a chronically mentally ill community in an intensive outpatient program. In 2000, I graduated from Loyola University, Chicago with a master's in social work. And I did training at Loyola University Sexual Dysfunction Clinic under Dr. Damina Rinsaw. So since 2000, I have been practicing clinically. And even when I've been working in a behavioral health care situation, I have continually added information related to sexuality.
Tiffany, what led you to specializing in the area of sexuality and psychotherapy? And what led you to become so passionate about the work that you do?
Yes, I absolutely love what I do. It's hard to even say it's a job. It's like I get to work with fabulous people and help them to help themselves so they can get the intimate life that they want and deserve. Many people ask, what got me into sex therapy? I started with a degree in psychology and a minor in criminal justice. I was attending some criminal justice courses. I really felt out of place. I was wearing, this is in, 1990 and 91 is when I started my freshman year. I was wearing Birkenstocks and long dresses. Discussing the word feminism seemed like a bad word in the criminal justice courses. I then added the elective of women and gender studies. And attending those courses just felt like freedom, felt like home. And so my initial intent was to be a psychologist, really trying to better understand criminal behavior. And I believe that's from some of my traumatic past where my dad did engage in criminal behavior. So having a lack of fit in the criminal justice courses and feeling at home and in place in women and gender studies and looking at I could actually be a Dr. Ruth. And how much more fun sex is than crime. I ended up changing my major to social work because I enjoyed the dual aspect of the biopsychosocial element to it, really working directly with clients in changing their environment, advocating for community change. And I received a minor in both sociology and women and gender studies. It was after I graduated in 95 that I even started some sex therapy training. So again, it was fabulous to go from crime to sex and to be able to focus on a topic that I actually had an increased level of comfort in. Even though I didn't go to graduate school until 2000, I found it really beneficial to get some base understanding around sexuality in a way to confirm my interest in this topic. After receiving my bachelor's degree and working in the intensive outpatient mental health program with chronically mentally ill clients who wanted to date, wanted to be able to be erotic, I created a healthy sexuality program for the group to talk about hygiene, appropriate communication, the effects of medication that was limiting their ability to have erections or changing their libido. So in different environments, I have been able to utilize my passion for healthy sexual expression.
How is it working with those that are chronically mentally ill and trying to assist them with these sexual concerns that they're having and trying to educate them compared to the individuals that you're now currently working with? What were some of the differences?
Oh, there's a drastic difference. The clients that I have on my sofa now are really high functioning adults without any serious mental illness. They tend to be middle to upper income and don't have the intensive side effects from the medication or issues with hygiene or emotional stability. Now, just being in the general population, people struggle with mild depression, mild anxiety. So there is only maybe a 1% correlation between the two different populations.
Mm-hmm.
I work in session with only adults. I tend to focus on erectile dysfunction, libido discrepancies, pelvic pain disorders, working within the lifestyle and kink community, providing presentations to cancer support groups. I had a peer of mine that had who was a social worker in a breast cancer center. And once she found out that I was in the community, she contacted me whether or not I could, provide a presentation. So the clients were asking for help in how do they still remain sexual with prostate cancer and dealing with biological impotency at the time. So working with prostate cancer groups was my first introduction into this population. Then the breast cancer social workers discovered that I was doing this type of psychoeducational services. And then I presented a variety of times to different groups with breast cancer.
Wow, the education that you're providing must be hugely beneficial to these individuals that are already going through a devastating life experience. And now you're providing help that will surely help them begin to regain some sense of normalcy, hopefully, and life as they once knew it.
I have a program called Cancer Sucks, Your Sex Life Doesn't Have To. It's kind of a theme that I've presented throughout my group opportunities, and I was asked to be a guest speaker at the Lymphoma Leukemia Society.
Mm-hmm.
I provided psychoeducation to nurses and physicians, and then had a second group that targeted the clients, caregivers, clients, their partners, so that they could realize that they're still an erotic being despite going through such a difficult process. And the dynamics really change in the marriage from, partner and lover to caretaker. And how do I sexualize someone that is so ill? So we talk about alternative ways to be able to maintain that erotic sense, to be able to step out of the caregiver and the ill person role to keep the marriage strong during such of a crisis situation. On my website, neworleanssextherapy.com, you can find information about my private practice that is on the North Shore of New Orleans, and it's in Covington. I have the closed Facebook group called From Low to Go, and it is for women 30 and over that are struggling with low libido in their relationships. Even though I've had a history in working with individuals with cancer, I tend to focus more specifically on libido, sexless marriages, libido discrepancies, also supporting and normalizing the lifestyle community. Those would be open relationships, polyamory, swinging, and looking at mixed orientation marriages. And lastly, the erectile dysfunction piece. Because I'm looking at, and again, this links just what I was saying to cancer, is you don't need an erection or to have penetration and an orgasm to have great sex. So with an erectile dysfunction concern, maybe one of those that have experienced cancer, someone in a low sex to no sex marriage, maybe one who has experienced another form of cancer or breast cancer, and feeling that they've lost their sexual self with losing of their breast, or a lack of sensitivity in the augmented breast. So I think that it can target a similar population, even though it isn't specific to those that have struggled with cancer. Now, I'm in the process of creating course content for the Low to Go. Right now, it is more of a psychoeducational support group for women. And then I'll be providing training programs, not from the stance of being a psychotherapist, but being an educator and giving specific suggestions that are solution-oriented to help them feel good in their own skin, to tap into their sexual energy, and to be open to sharing that with their partner. On a surprising note, I was in an interview with John and Jackie Melfi, who are entrepreneurs and have the clubs in Louisiana and Texas called Colette's. And so that is for the swinging and lifestyle community. I am involved in their World Love Summit, which will be released around winter time. Yeah. So around November, December, that's going to come out. And it's so interesting because I would think of John and Jackie as experts in the field of lifestyle, because that's their business, that's their activity. And when they were interviewing me, they were excited as well as surprised by some of the points that I brought up, such as if you're in the swinging community and you struggle with erectile dysfunction, that's much more difficult than struggling with it in your own bedroom, because other people are watching, or because you're choosing to be sexual with another individual. And how you can continue to be sexual without having the erection. The other piece is you can actually be monogamous and be in the lifestyle, which people have trouble putting those two things together, because there is a stereotype that swingers just go out there and they just want to have sex with everybody. And it's all a big orgy. And there might be an orgy room at the party that you attend, or a portion of one of the rooms that they have in Colette's clubs. And there's other lifestyle clubs, you know, throughout the US, actually throughout the world. And you can be monogamous by watching other individuals, going into one of the semi-private rooms and being sexual with your partner with a sheer curtain that covers it. And so people can kind of stand up and watch you through the sheer curtain. Or you can open the curtain and allow other people to watch you and engage in sex play, just the two of you. So I find that exciting and fun, and not known enough that you can maintain monogamy within your relationship and still have fun within the lifestyle. I attended in July of 2018 the Naughty in New Orleans that's been happening for years, and it's a lifestyle convention. And out of all the conventions I have ever attended, this was the most fun and the nicest people. And I made the joke that I wasn't hit on once. I was there with the person that I'm dating, and he and I participated, but very monogamously. And it was humorous that I'm like, nobody has asked me to go up into the party room with them, or no one has asked me if I soft swing or do the full swing. So they think again that you're going to go into one of these lifestyle conventions and people's going to grope all over you. No, it is a group of like-minded individuals that support sexual freedom and the ability to engage in consensual non-monogamy. So if I go back to the interview that I had with John and Jackie Melfi, they were excited to hear about continuing sex play without an erection, being able to be open to participate in the lifestyle even when you remain monogamous with your partner.
Can you tell people where they can find the interview that you mentioned a couple of times if they would like to hear more about it?
It is on openlove101.com. And we have John and Jackie do a variety of interviews. I don't know if it's weekly or biweekly, and they provide a ton of information regarding the lifestyle community. This World Love Summit, as I said, will be released in the wintertime of 2018. After that, because I think it's only free for one day, after that, it's a purchable video series. And I'm uncertain if they have 10 to 15 different experts that are on there. And each of us come from a different angle. Those that are active in consensual non-monogamy, polyamory, are in the erotic field in their profession. And so I'm coming from it as a clinician. So I could be a little bit boring in comparison with some of the other presenters, but they should be able to access it. I believe there will be a cost. Once this comes out, I will place it on my website and they can directly access it through there.
If I go back to the interview that I had with John and Jackie Melfi, they were excited to hear about continuing sex play without an erection, being able to be open to participate in the lifestyle even when you remain monogamous with your partner. It is on openlove101.com. John and Jackie do a variety of interviews. I don't know if it's weekly or biweekly, and they provide a ton of information regarding the lifestyle community. This World Love Summit, as I said, will be released in the wintertime of 2018. After that, because I think it's only free for one day, after that, it's a purchable video series, and I'm uncertain if they have 10 to 15 different experts that are on there. And each of us come from a different angle, are active in consensual non-monogamy, polyamory, are in the erotic field in their profession. And so I'm coming from it as a clinician.
On your Facebook page, I saw something that looked like a Mardi Gras festival, and you were with a man. Was that Mardi Gras or was that something else?
Oh, that was part of Nadia New Orleans. And we did a sexual freedom parade on Bourbon Street, and the theme was white. So most of us wore white, or some people wore costumes, and some had limited amount of clothing on, and many of us had signs representing our view of sexual freedom. And one of the most common questions I receive is, am I normal? And it's humorous to me, like, you're going to pay me to tell you how normal you are. The definition of normal is adult, consensual, respectful to all parties involved. And so that was the sign that I made and walked through Bourbon Street, walked down Royal Street in pride. You know, I am excited to share the message and normalize the variety of consensual, respectful sexual behaviors. We don't have to keep ourselves in a box. Puritanical messages, particularly then in the Victorian era. You know, in the Victorian era, they even had to cover the legs of chairs because they might elicit sexual arousal. Women had to wear corsets, of course, because it was popular to, I think, have like a waist size of 18. So it was covering the full body. It was cinching up the waist. And it was actually popularizing fainting women, very thin women who weren't very sexual, which is interesting because we had to do so many things to prevent a sexual response. Yet there was overt sexualization in the minds of people without the behavior that linked to it. If we look at the late 1800s, women weren't supposed to want sex. Now I have clients coming in, females coming in saying, what's wrong with me that I don't want to have sex a couple times a week? Well, in 100 years, there's been a vast transformation as to what is our norm. If we look at the very exciting norm that is now being created, which is the legalization of gay marriages, I am so excited by that. And now we're having increased normalization of individuals with transgender identity. Now, both of those, you know,
being gay or being transgendered still unfortunately have a lot of discrimination in our society, yet we're moving forward. And I want to make sure that I'm an advocate for sexual equality. Again, adult, consensual, respectful to all parties involved. Go for it.
You have a podcast as well. What is the name of that podcast, Tiffany?
My podcast is called Tiffany Turned On, and you can find it on iTunes and Spotify, Spreaker. It's also linked to my YouTube account, which is New Orleans Sex Therapy. It's, you don't see a video of me, but it's a video where you can kind of see the lines of when I'm talking. And in Tiffany Turned On, I have just a handful right now, I think maybe 8 podcasts, and I'm tending to cover a little bit more of risque behavior in regards of our cultural norms in hopes to normalize. Yet I want to diversify that piece as well. So I had a 3-part series called Sleeping with 100 Married Men. I just released Jealousy in Relationships, so that would relate more to the traditional monogamous piece, then Jealousy in Open Relationships. I have one on infidelity in marriage. So, you know, there's going to be different topics coming up monthly, if not 2 times a month. It just depends upon what's on my schedule. What I want to do versus what I have the time to do can be 2 different things. And I just talk in a very relaxed manner about different things that happen. You know, my mother says, and I think my mother's fairly young. She's 20 years older than I. She's 66. And she says, oh, Tiff, I'm going to listen to all of them. You might not want to. And she unfortunately had experiences of a high level of betrayal. So when I did the podcast related to sleeping with 100 married men, she initially wanted to vilify the woman. And I said, I might be a little bit too biased because I don't have any negative judgment of someone that chooses consensual sex with the married person. I don't judge that. We have a cheating rate of 20 to 50%. We have Ashley Madison out there. Why? Because there's a need. And I think that Washington, D.C. actually has the most registrants in the whole U.S. They list the top 5, but I do remember that D.C. was on the top of there. So I tend to be biased only in regards of the open-minded aspect in normalizing things. And so I ask her, you know, if she could give me some suggestions of maybe more difficult questions to ask. After listening to all 3 episodes, she seemed to have a better understanding that the men are out there on Ashley Madison because they're choosing to step out of the marriage. The women who respond aren't home wreckers, aren't interested in developing a long-term relationship with the individual. And she wondered, like, what does this woman look like? You know, she was kind of making a presumption that maybe the woman was overtly sexualized in her behavior and makeup. And my interviewee is an intelligent, educated woman who could be a paralegal, who could be a teacher. You know, there's nothing about her external appearance that would indicate that she has had such sexually liberal experiences.
There are many things I like about your podcast, but one thing in particular is how candid you are. And you talk openly about sexually transmitted diseases to include herpes, which you discussed could be spread in unexpected ways, most likely to most people, it would be unexpected. And you talked about that, I believe, in the podcast episode segment regarding sleeping with 100 married men. And there are so many people who just focus on the glamorized aspect of sex and sexuality and, you know, Instagram, the selfies, the body parts being posted, everything's plumped up and pushed up and everyone's in their little leggings, everything looks all perfect. But you actually talk about all aspects of sexuality on your podcast, not just the glamorized portions of it. And I find that to be very commendable.
Yeah, I do tend to add in research statistics as well. And the first part that you talked about was our excessive selfies. It is really a vain society that we're creating right now, really a narcissistic focus. Having a teenage son and being in the car, he would take like 5 selfies on the way to Target. Really? Yeah, I might be giving him less than he actually was taking. What's happening, though, is teenagers and people in the young 20s are having more relationships online, more validation online, instead of validation in their own self-worth, in their abilities intellectually and within friendships, and having empathy and hope and sharing love with others in a very healthy way. It's more, look at me, look at me, look at me, like my page, like my image, so I feel good in who I am.
Yes, I absolutely agree with what you're saying. I am a huge online person, as you know, with how we met online with Instagram. And I'm a huge fan of your podcast. That's how I initially found out that you exist, because I love your podcast so much. And then here we are recording this podcast in a digital recording studio. Online is amazing. I love it. But the fact of the matter is there are dangers to being online too. Not only can everyone check you out and cyberstalk you if they choose to do so and twist and manipulate whatever they find about you online, but also, which even can be a little bit scarier, is that when you have too much reliance on the internet and forming online relationships that way, and you don't meet people in person or really vet them, or you know, maybe they are local in your area, they can easily gain too much information about you and figure out what your weak spots are, and then use it to really manipulate you and prey upon you in a way that they are advancing their own agenda at your expense. And then maybe you meet them in person. And I'm not talking about like the ID channel here where someone ends up getting killed, but instead you meet them in person and you realize that connection was fake. It was disingenuous. It was artificial. It didn't really exist. And they were just playing you the whole time to advance their own agenda. And you figure this out because their body language, their facial expressions, their tone of voice, their, you know, mannerisms, part of body language. And you realize that, oh, it's really easy to be fake and to seemingly form a meaningful connection online only to find out when you meet them in person, especially if you're not doing video online, you know, face to face that way, that they were just fake the whole time, like with their behavior, and they never cared about you in the first place. And I'm not talking about necessarily romantic relationships either. Of course, that could be the case, but also platonic relationships, work relationships, friendships, so on and so forth. So while I met you online and everything, you really have to be careful about who it is you're meeting online or who it is you're communicating with online, even if you've met them in person, because you don't want to be taken advantage of.
What I also wanted to mention, just going back, is I'm shocked at the amount of nude selfies that are.
Have you ever heard of the show Wendy Williams?
I haven't watched it, but I do know that she had a show or has a show out. Did she talk about nude selfies?
Yeah, so Wendy Williams is just a gossipy show that I love to watch. You should watch it if it's something you want to get your mind off of. And Wendy Williams frequently shows naked selfies that people have taken of themselves, hence the name selfie. And they'll be in, let's say, a G-string with tons of flesh showing and, you know, the back of their body. You will be showing possibly, and they'll have these digital stickies all over themselves because, you know, the Wendy Williams show have to cover up certain body parts so that it is considered appropriate for television viewing audiences, whatever that means. And Kim Kardashian is frequently featured on this show in her various states of undress in these selfies. And so other people are as well. But I just think about Wendy Williams, her show, every time something like this comes up, it just makes me laugh.
I don't see very many nude selfies myself. So my girlfriend was dating and she was receiving nude selfies and she would just randomly send them to me. And I would have to respond, okay, whose penis is that? And did you ask for that picture?
One thing that really scares me these days is the concept of revenge porn, which many people are living with the horrifying reality of, where they had a video or images of some kind that were intimate in nature of themselves in vulnerable positions in different various states of undress now being posted online because someone's upset that they were broken up with or they got into a fight with the person and they want to humiliate them online by posting these horrible, graphic images and videos that were supposed to be private and now are quite public. And it distorts many people's lives. Specifically, many people experiencing this are women. And I've noticed a huge number of just law firms coming out of the woodwork all of a sudden that specialize in helping people take down revenge porn and filing civil lawsuits against the individuals that have posted it because it is so damaging to these specifically women's lives since they're oftentimes the victim of this. However, I'm sure it probably does happen to men on occasion as well. None of these individuals that are being victimized by people and choosing to engage in revenge porn, as they call it, consented to having these graphic images and videos posted online.
The word that was jumping out to me was consent. And looking at how we behave online and how we behave in person is drastically different. Sticking with the topic of getting some nude selfies, teenagers are doing this. Teenage girls and boys are taking nude selfies, engaging in sex at an earlier age. And what I often say is, how about you feel good with your nude body without anybody else giving you a thumbs up or, you know, a heart emoji, and you actually look at your genitals, you explore your own body, you think about what turns you on and turns you off. Because what I hear is these young ladies are being sexual and allowing someone else's face in their genitals without even looking at their own, without even having a sense of self-confidence, that it's more of a validating sexual behavior or feeling like they have to behave in a certain way to fit in versus it coming from a place of understandable developmental sexual exploration. And it's this external validation. It is not an intrinsic value. It's the extrinsic value. You mentioned also STDs, and I provided on one of my websites that there really isn't any increased risk of STDs in the lifestyle community. When you go to the swingers club, you get towels, wet wipes, condoms, lube. I think people would be surprised that the rate of STDs isn't any bigger in the lifestyle community than it is in the general population. Now, this is old news, so I'd need to research it for new news or updated news. And that was some of the highest rate of STDs are happening right now in the elderly population because they feel like we don't have to worry about pregnancy. I'm sure this person doesn't have any STD. We don't need to use a condom. We don't need to use a dental dam. We're just going to go out there and have some fun. So that is a population that also really needs education. When I was mentioning on the podcast about STDs, is that condoms help prevent HIV, syphilis, gonorrhea, and pregnancy. But venereal warts and herpes and even syphilis are contracted on the labial area. So, you know, a lot of us will think about the lips of our genitals. It also happens on the perineum, which is the space between our vaginal canal and our rectum, or even in the rectal area. So if we are having intercourse with a male, it is very common for their testicles to hit the lower portion of our genital region. And that can transmit the warts, herpes, and syphilis. So it's really unfortunate that even condoms definitely have a limitation in the safety that they can provide. So I want more clients to understand that. I want them to have a discussion with the person about their history of STDs. People will say, oh, I'm too uncomfortable to have that conversation. But you're comfortable enough to share your genitals with them? You know, that to me is a little bit of a conundrum. The other piece in related to social media and sexualizing ourselves, and to the Kardashians make a lot of money and looking really sexy. But that gives us no insight into a healthy sex life with her partner. You know, she's sexualizing her body, but is she tuned into her erotic self? Is she having a rich and passionate sex life? We don't know. And we have young ladies dressing minimally to gain attention. And what I really like is nudist colonies. That's not the right word. Parks, clubs, beaches. There we go. There we go. Because you attend a nude beach, well, for me, being very fair-skinned and red hair, I have to be covered in sunblock. But there is no pretentiousness. There's no sexualization of the body. It's a normalization, a sense of freedom, and authenticity. And when we wear these skimpy outfits, when we sexualize ourselves on social media, I really challenge the authenticity to it. But when you're at a nude beach or a nude club, the sexualization of that is very limited, and it's more about the freedom. So to me, those are individuals that feel good about their body. And let me tell you, I don't know if I see anyone that is a size 6 for females or males who have a stereotypical six-pack. These are real people like you and me feeling comfortable in their body without a need to get that thumbs up or that heart response on social media.
Yeah. Young women in particular, I think, are much less self-aware of how what they're wearing and how they present themselves impacts the way that people perceive them, specifically men, of course, but also women as well. And I grew up in a beach town, touristy place. Nobody wore very much clothing, lots of swimsuits, lots of shorts, very sunny place, very warm. And I really wasn't aware of that either because everyone around me was wearing much the same clothing because it was so hot constantly, and that was the norm. But then when I relocated and joined the Army, of course, it was a total culture shock. I was wearing, you know, a uniform that covered absolutely, you know, from neck all the way to my toes. And then in the States I lived thereafter were a completely different culture. And it was an expectation that you would wear very conservative clothing in comparison to the beach town that I grew up in. And so that was a huge culture shock and a huge adjustment for many months thereafter. And unfortunately, there's a lot of sexism in our country and globally, and women are viewed as commodities to be bought, sold, and traded by many people, and are often at times treated as trophies instead of as humans as they should be treated. And so there's a lot of assumptions made about people depending upon what clothing that they wear. And that may be include thinking that they deserve less respect and less consideration. And I actually plan on doing a video podcast on sex workers deserve respect too. I kind of jumped topics there, but basically this assumption that because of your occupation or your lack of clothing or what have you, that you deserve less respect, less consideration, and should not be able to consent or refuse.
So you were talking about strippers, and I like to use the word erotic dancers. People do not realize how much work goes into being an erotic dancer, how you have to keep your body, how you have to perform these skills on stage, how you have to converse with a multitude of individuals in the evening, how overly stimulating the environment is with the lights and the music. It is exhausting hard work, and I don't hear any validation of that. I unfortunately hear judgment of these professional women. Now, some of them are there for not the healthiest reasons, but many are there of their own will of feeling good in their body and wanting to be entertainers. There is a negative stereotype, like if you were a male and you take your girlfriend home and the parents say, "What do?" And they say erotic dancer, it's almost like they get down to the chopping block of a lack of worth. So I'm really glad to hear that you're going to be doing a cast on that, to not only normalize, but to promote the self-esteem and worth of women that happen to enjoy performance art. And this is one form of performance art. I have worked with individuals in the industry, and there is an issue with consent. It's like, okay, if I'm an erotic dancer, then you can just come up and grab my breasts. You can smack me on the bum. No. You know, I am here to dance for you on stage. I am here to dance for you with your hands off to entertain you. And I'm here to converse with you. Mm-hmm. And even though you're objectifying my body physically, you need to keep your hands down because that is not consent. So we want women to be sexualized in media, but if they then engage in sexualized behavior, they're then challenged as amoral. And we have a distinct double standard in our society. If we think about men who have slept with 20 women, they may get a high five. If we think of women who've slept with 20 men, they may get an unfortunate label of being a slut, and there's slut shaming really occurring right now. And there is a movement for women to embrace their sexual self, their ability to make safe, sane sexual decisions that no label of slut applies. If they choose to be with a handful of partners, then they choose to do that. And it's the same with males. I prefer the term in the sex industry or erotic industry as an erotic dancer, because when we put that word stripper in there or prostitute, I think that comes into the category of negative labeling that we have, just like in your example. I don't know if you'd want to Law and Order. And so what we're doing is we're demonizing and labeling women who are in this industry that it does take a lot of effort. And I want these women to feel empowered to make their own choices and empowered without judgment from our community, because there again is another double standard. Like I mentioned, hey, look half naked and I'm going to send you a like on social media. But if you happen to be an erotic dancer or a date for hire, then you are somehow less than, you know, the disempowerment that occurs. Oh goodness, I'm forgetting the name of this movie. It was fabulous. And she was a sex surrogate and it was Helen Hunt. Goodness, I don't know what it is. If you find it out, I'd love for you to add it into this podcast. It's really worthy of watching. It destigmatizes the role of sexual surrogacy. And I am a proponent for making that legal in our society. I know that there is a real different view within the community of those who specialize in sex and relationships. Yet I believe in some circumstances, it is valid. In her situation that the movie was based upon, it was a man with an illness that was paralyzing. And he knew he was going to die soon, and he wanted to experience sex and pleasure before he passed away. And the disabled community, they are desexualized, if I should say. Yeah. So you can't be in a wheelchair and be a hottie. You can't have cerebral palsy and to be wanted sexually. And sexual surrogacy can not only help in giving pleasure to these individuals, but it can increase their confidence and their ability of worth as a sexual being outside of what might be their physical disabilities. When I was receiving my initial training in specializing in sex, I watched a video of a quadriplegic man in a large shower with his wife. And he had sensation from his neck up, and his wife rubbed her whole body on him. And it was one of the most erotic scenes that I have ever seen. And I have watched a fair amount of sexual images and videos. So it's interesting to see the level of real pleasure that was occurring in a situation that could be viewed as desexualizing this individual. And it was so passionate. So I want to advocate for those that struggle with illnesses and disabilities, that they still are erotic beings, as long as they have the cognitive ability for consent. So who would think a porn or a video with a quadriplegic man would be hot? And it was hot because of the passion, because of the realness behind it. Let's go to anger. Okay. When we have couples with conflict, who in the world doesn't have anger? Right. And I mean, that is just a common denominator. And underneath anger, many times, is hurt, disappointment, contempt, defensiveness. And it's important to help our clients to look at the vast aspect that anger covers up. Many men do a great job showing anger versus grief, showing anger versus vulnerability. Now, I don't want to point out men in particular, yet there is an increased expression of anger from men instead of looking at, I really feel hurt and betrayed. I'm really grieving that our relationship is failing. It tends to come out as, I'm pissed off at you. I hate you. You look what you have done. Again, the slut shaming. Look what you have done with this other person. How dare you? You're evil. It's understandable to feel betrayed and hurt if you have an agreed upon monogamous relationship. So anger is really common in even high functioning relationships. It depends upon how it's handled and communicated and how we cope with our own anger. Our anger is on us. So as a parent, I would say it's okay to be mad. It's not okay to be mean. And the same thing applies to adults. And so you may want to rage and you may want to call out this person with name calling and belittling. Yet where does that get you? That gets no problem solving, no healing. It doesn't help really understanding the pain that the person is in. It's more about punishing the other person. So anger is a frequent dynamic. There's multiple layers to it. It's seen in most situations in couples therapy. Now, I do have couples come in that are best friends, have fantastic communication, but their bedroom is more like dry toast. And I utilize a lot of John Gottman training, which is, you know, linked with cognitive behavioral therapy. And he discusses the four horsemen and he discusses contempt, defensiveness, withdrawal. Defensiveness can come out as anger. It's really about a wall that we put up to protect ourselves. And what if we said, I want to lash out right now. I want to put up this wall. I'm feeling attacked. The words that you stated, A, B, and C, felt really attacking. Was that your intent? And then we want to look at what is the role that I'm playing? You know, so if my partner said something that, oh, with criticism, yes, I made it. My memory came back. Okay. We would want to look at what is our role of responsibility in it. And in contempt, that feeling is I am better than you. What in the world? How can we have a good sex life without equality, without shared power? And so in contempt, what we want clients to do is to really appreciate the positive attributes of their partner. And in the withdrawal or shutdown mode, sometimes, and it's 80% of men who do this, sometimes we think, oh, look, he's just ignoring me. And so women can trump up their anger. You know, we'll kind of have the situation where the man is walking away and we have the woman practically on his heels to stay and listen to me. Well, what's happening is a part of the brain is shutting down its ability to respond. Your heart rate is going above 100 and you're unconscious of all of it. And so shutting down is a coping mechanism. When we allow the person to have some sense of timeout to distract themselves, to get their heart rate down, then they can come back to listening. Stonewalling is the word for that. And some women do that, but it's more common in men. And it tends to really trigger the women because they feel ignored when, well, there could be some cases of ignoring, but a lot of times it is that their heart rate is up, that the blood flow is going back from the prefrontal cortex, that they're having a flooding of cortisol. And we're not going to have those thoughts when we're really angry that, oh, let me make up a scenario. You went out and bought a car when we're in a financial crisis. You are not walking away from me. Get back here. I want you to sell this car. We can't take this on. So many people, of course, would find that irresponsible and would have an anger response to it. What we want in conflict, because conflict is guaranteed, is we want for both of us to be able to soothe ourselves enough so that we can communicate in a way that problem solves. And if you can't communicate in a way that problem solves, then you need to say, I know this needs to be handled. My brain is so frazzled and I want to respond in a biting way. And I need to take a time out for myself so I can come back in 2 hours and actually act like a human. And I can talk about my decision making for it. And we can talk about maybe a compromise in regards of what's happening financially in my buying this car. And I will be able to look at whether or not that was an impulsive purchase. But when you don't have the blood flow in the front, when you have the flood of cortisol, you are not going to problem solve. it's almost like arguing with someone who's drunk. You're not going to get anywhere. Yeah. So it's giving yourself a pause, thinking about your timing, not avoiding the topic, but bringing it in when you can actually both be heard. When talking to someone on the phone, I ask them if they can summarize in two sentences, or, you know, if we're having a text dialogue, in two sentences, what is it that is bringing them there? I don't work with individuals that have addiction or that label themselves with sex addiction. If they say I'm uncertain, then I give them the option to come in to do a diagnostic assessment, and I can make a recommendation at that time whether or not it is more of a poor coping skill, or if it was based on early sexual abuse that they're reenacting, or if just attending a Sex Anonymous support group meeting might be enough to help them keep their sexual behavior under control. Most of those individuals I refer out. I also don't work with individuals that have any sexual behavior that's been linked to the court system, or individuals that have pedophilic fantasies, so child fantasies, or have engaged in violating a child, or those who have eroticism linked to animals. So I will joke around about no addiction, no crime, no kids, no animals. And people will laugh about it, yet that's, you know, sexual behavior that does occur. If I feel that clients need more than I can provide, I can refer out for individual therapy, because I prefer to work with couples. But sometimes the individual needs to have the focus on themselves. And I can refer to one of my colleagues in particular that does have training in sexual addiction. So that would be provided more in a private practice. I have in the last couple of years referred two clients out to not individual therapy, but inpatient treatment. And they didn't present with an addiction, but it came out that was so obvious. They were willing to ruin their careers because they were so out of control with their sexual behavior. So those are the things that I rule out. And most other things in the sexual arena, with the sexless marriages, libido indiscrepancies, lifestyle and kink, erectile dysfunction, having a chronic illness and wanting to maintain their erotic self, pelvic floor disorders, you know, I feel really comfortable in being able to treat those aspects. And I also work collaboratively with physicians as well as physical therapists. It's sex addiction support group. We have River Oaks Hospital that's in New Orleans that has a whole inpatient and outpatient sexual addiction center. So that would be one of my referral sources, to send someone that struggles with addiction, because that is an area that I don't work in. I feel like if you work in addictions, that's where you need to stay. And because if you're so focused on that and you have the training for that, that's the gift to the client. I don't have the training in that. They need to see someone who is.
And sex addiction is, in my opinion, a subspecialty. That's not something that I do, but I spoke with someone recently on the podcast that does do that. And that will keep you busy all by itself, just about the issues surrounding that, as well as that one issue. So, Tiffany, how can people find out more about the work that you do?
Well, on my website, which is neworleanssextherapy.com, I have some videos there. It also links to my podcast, which is Tiffany Turned On, as I mentioned. I have New Orleans Sex Therapy Facebook page, as well as my new group that, again, is the closed group for women 30 and over that have low libido or a lack of interest in sex in their relationships. I'm going to be creating course content for those ladies. In the spring, I'm looking forward to creating another group related to mix-oriented marriages and having online courses related to that. So a brief side note is, in the lifestyle community, it's almost expected for women to be bisexual, but for men to be bisexual, there's still a taboo. And even if you're looking at monogamous marriages, there tends to be more tolerance of bisexual females than there is to be married to a man who is bisexual. So I'm going to be providing more specialized services in that area with online training. So people can do that from the privacy of their home, like you talked about. It's really hard to come into therapy. And getting healthy, appropriate sex education online can be beneficial. Hoping to open a coaching practice this spring. So I'd be able to do some online treatment, but it wouldn't be in the role of a psychotherapist. It would be more in the role of coaching, solution orientation, and psychoeducational. And that will be on my regular website that will link you to an upcoming website that I will create with my courses and with my coaching opportunities, which would be video and on the phone.
Well, you're helping a lot of people, especially get past the fear of being judged and get the help that they actually need to move forward in their lives. So that is hugely beneficial.
Well, there's so much shame, like with sexuality. You know, women think they're all supposed to have orgasms with intercourse alone. Men believe that just the woman sitting on their lap, they're supposed to have an erection. Men believe their penises need to be over 6 inches. Women now are like, what's wrong with me that I'm not squirting or having female ejaculation? All these messages, these mixed messages from the media and from porn that state what is the norm. And that isn't necessarily isn't necessarily true at all. So I want clients to feel good in their own skin, to create a sex life that fits for them and experiences passion, exploration, consent, and playfulness. I have a TEDx talk that you can find online, and it's called I Love Pleasure. And I talk about the importance of kind of kicking out erection and intercourse in the bedroom. And people are shocked when I tell them that. Because what? You specialize in sex and you're kicking out sex? No, I'm just kicking that out a little bit. So you can focus more on the erotic pleasure that you experience, the emotional connection that you're having with the partner. And let's get performance and pressure out of your bedroom, because this is not about performing. If so, you need to be on stage.
Your TED talk was amazing. I watched it and I was really impressed. I will make sure I put the link to it directly into the podcast description so that people can watch it too.
Great.
Thank you, Tiffany, for your time and for your participation. I greatly appreciate you contributing your expertise.
Well, as you can tell, I just love what I do. So it's really easy for me to talk about it. And I'm sure I could even talk about it longer.